the International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to take all measures to prevent genocide in Gaza, but it fails to call for a ceasefire in the besieged Palestinian territory. Palestinians hailed the preliminary ruling by the top UN court, saying it will contribute to isolating the Zionist regime. And the Israeli regime continues its relentless attacks on Gaza, where the death toll has topped 26,000, mostly women and children. Thank you for joining us. Now, the International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to try and prevent genocidal acts being committed inside Gaza, but stopped short of ordering a ceasefire. In a move that has frustrated pro-Palestinian activists, only six of the special measures requested by South Africa were granted by the ICJ, including increased humanitarian aid to be allowed into the devastated Palestinian territory, where over 26,000 have already been killed in the US-Israeli genocide. Here's more.
It was a ruling weeks in the making. Lawyers acting for South Africa had requested the International Court of Justice implement special measures that would prevent more deaths and a further humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. This whilst the main case of genocide is considered against Tel Aviv, a process which could take years.
In the court's view, the aforementioned facts and circumstances are sufficient to conclude that at least some of the rights claimed by South Africa and for which it is seeking protection are plausible. This is the case with respect to the right of Palestinians in Gaza to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts identified in Article 3, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligations under the convention.
Free Palestine! Outside the court, pro-Palestinian activists had a mixed response.
It is a bittersweet feeling that I'm having now. It's as if finally there is international recognition that the Palestinian people are facing the threat of genocide, that they are facing vicious war crimes. And it's as if we have to be grateful that they're finally recognizing it, right? And to hear also the evidence that the judge stated was very painful to hear, all this evidence there. But still, the people on the ground right now, I don't think it will benefit them at all on the short term. So it's also very painful to realize that.
The whole world knows it. They are exposed. That means that the people, the normal people who are not affected by the politics, will know the truth, will know that there is a genocide there. Israel cannot hide it anymore. They are exposed. And now the most important thing is that every complicit party has to know that they will be the next. Israel may escape with it, but the other complicit parties will not.
That gave me hope, and that reminded me that this is a long struggle, and even though a ceasefire has not been ordered, which is a bitter pill for us to swallow, but this is still a victory. This is the first time that Israel has been officially, quite clearly reprimanded, and as Muin Rabbani, the Palestinian analyst, said, this is a stain on them forever.
Of Foreign Affairs on 6 December 2023.
The muted response to the ICJ's interim ruling shows that it wasn't just occupation Israel that was in the dock in the building behind me, but actually it was institutions like the ICJ, like the UN's top court, because people want to know that they can have justice that is tied to what's going on and not simply to Western political interests. The European Union has said it respects the decision of the court and expects all parties to comply. Meanwhile, Israeli ministers have taken to social media to call out both the ICJ for attempting to lecture Tel Aviv and again calling the South African case anti-Semitic. South Africa, who brought the action against Israel to the ICJ, acknowledged the six measures granted would be difficult to implement without a ceasefire.
This case was very much about international bodies ensuring that they exercise their responsibility to protect us all as global citizens.
From the river to the sea! From the river to the
sea! Israel has 1 month to make its initial report to the ICJ to show compliance of the special measures requested. Palestinians have indicated they will not hold their breaths. Amina Taylor, The Hague.
The Palestinian Assistant Foreign Minister Ammar Hijazi calls on all states to ensure that the top UN court orders are completely enforced.
Israel now will stand trial accused of committing the crime of all crimes. We call on states that to ensure that all provisional measures ordered by the court are implemented. States and governments have clear obligations in light of this order. First and foremost, they must make sure they are not complicit in this genocide. This is a good day for humanity. This ruling is in favor of international system based on law and against exceptionalism and double standards. It should be a wake-up call for Israel and its enablers. The State of Palestine will undertake every endeavor to follow up on this important ruling by the courts towards ensuring the rights of the Palestinian people and ensuring justice. To this end, and with deep conviction in the rule of law, we will continue pursuing accountability and justice in all forms, including in the few weeks' time when we return here to the ICJ on the 19th of February for the oral hearings in the advisory opinion proceedings on Israel's illegal occupation and regime inside the occupied Palestinian territory. This illegal occupation and apartheid regime must be brought to an end.
Meanwhile, the South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor says a ceasefire in Gaza is not enough and as an occupier, Israel should provide the necessary basic services to Palestinians.
I wish to begin by thanking the judges of the International Court of Justice for dealing with this matter expeditiously. Given the urgency of the need to protect innocent civilians in Palestine and to ensure that the harm that South Africa has referred to in the case it brought before the ICJ, that harm is addressed and that people's lives are saved. The saving of life is not merely with respect to having a ceasefire, it's to ensuring that humanitarian aid is provided to those who need support, as well as ensuring that the State of Israel, which is currently the occupier and administrator in Palestine, provides the necessary basic services that the residents of Gaza and the West Bank require.
And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says all states should respect the top UN court order in the Gaza genocide case against Israel.
This order is binding on Israel and must be respected by all states that are party to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. We expect Israel, as a self-proclaimed democracy, and a state that respects the rule of law, to abide by the measures handed down by the International Court of Justice. After more than half a century of occupation, dispossession, oppression, and apartheid, the Palestinian people's cries for justice have been heeded by an eminent organ of the United Nations. Today, Israel stands before the international community, its crimes against the Palestinians laid bare. Since October last year, the people of Gaza have been the victims of bombardment and strikes from land, sea, and air. Homes, refugee camps, and entire neighborhoods have been destroyed, and not even schools and hospitals and religious places have been spared.
Iran has welcomed the top UN court's preliminary ruling in South Africa's genocide case against Israel, saying the regime must be brought to justice. In a phone call with his South African counterpart, the Iranian president warned of efforts by Israel and its allies to distort court proceedings. Ibrahim Raisi said the international community also expects the regime to be convicted in the court's final verdict. He stressed that Muslim nations and all freedom seekers worldwide commend South Africa's courageous move to take Israel to the ICJ at a time of inaction by international organizations. Raisi told Cyril Ramaphosa that his name would now be etched in history as an anti-racism and justice-seeking icon alongside Nelson Mandela. For his part, Ramaphosa stressed that opposition by some of Israel's allies would not deter South Africa from taking action against the regime's acts of genocide. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the ICJ ruling on South Africa's genocide case against Israel contributes to the regime's isolation. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zuhri called the court's decision an important development. He said the ruling helps expose the regime's crimes in the Gaza Strip. He also called for necessary measures to force Israel to fully implement the ICJ orders. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also welcomed the court's decision, saying the ruling is in favor of humanity and international law.
Palestine welcomes the provisional measures ordered by the International Court of Justice today. The ICJ judges assessed the facts and the law. They ruled in favor of humanity and international law. We call in all states to ensure that all provisional measures ordered by the court are implemented, including by Israel, the occupying power. This is a binding legal obligation. States now have clear legal obligations to stop Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinian people in Gaza and to make sure that they are not complicit.
Riyad al-Maliki said the ICJ ruling is an important reminder that no one is above the law. He said the order serves as a wake-up call for Israel and all its allies who enabled the regime's entrenched impunity. Israeli Prime Minister, on the other hand, called the order a disgrace that won't be erased for generations. Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue the onslaught until what he called the elimination of all threats and release of all captives in Gaza. Now reactions are pouring in to the interim ruling by the International Court of Justice on the genocide case against Israel. The European Union said it wanted, quote, full, immediate and effective implementation of the UN court ruling. The EU emphasized that the ICJ orders are binding and Israel must comply with them. Scotland's Prime Minister said the court's order is clear and must be abided by. He reiterated his country's call for an immediate ceasefire, urging Israel to stop its wide-scale killing and destruction in Gaza. Spain also welcomed the court's decision, calling for the implementation of the interim measures it has decreed. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan described the order as valuable, demanding an end to the Israeli attacks against civilians in Gaza, especially women and children. The death toll from nearly 4 months of Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip has surpassed 26,000. The Gaza Health Ministry says more than three-quarters of the fatalities are women and children. Israel is also pushing its indiscriminate strikes on the infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, including healthcare facilities. Doctors Without Borders is warning that Gaza no longer has a functioning healthcare system. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has ambushed Israeli forces in central Gaza, killing and injuring several of them. The regime says 220 of its troops have been killed during the incursion into Gaza. Hamas, however, says the actual number is much higher. The Yemeni army says it has targeted a British oil tanker in a military operation in the Gulf of Aden. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the missile strike set the vessel on fire. Sari says the attack was in response to the American-British aggression against Yemen and in solidarity with Palestine. The spokesman also says Yemeni military operations in the region will continue until a ceasefire is achieved in Gaza and food and medicine are allowed into the besieged strip. Yemeni forces have targeted over 24 Israeli-run or Israeli-bound vessels in the Red Sea. Yemeni forces have also been targeting American and British ships after the US and Britain launched attacks on Yemen. Meanwhile, thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets in the capital Sana'a and other cities to hail their army's anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. They also reiterated their unwavering support for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and across the occupied territories. Abdul Latif al-Bushali reports from Sana'a.
Yemenis from different walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They commended the Yemeni army for its operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. They also reiterated their steadfast support for the Palestinian people.
The whole world is watching the Israeli genocidal war against the Palestinian people and its result and repercussions. Yemenis are also following what's happening with all their feelings. If what happened to the Palestinian people had happened to other people in the world, the situation would have been the same. The Palestinian people have been suffering for 75 years from continuous occupation, displacement, killing, and indiscriminate attacks, and they need us to stand with them, as we have one language, one religion, and as we are both suffering from oppression.
Protesters condemned the aggression of the US and UK against their country, while also expressing readiness to stand against the entire world in support of their Palestinian brothers.
The goal of the American-British aggression was to stop the Yemeni army's naval attacks, but they completely failed in achieving this goal. The strikes continue and nothing has happened except that they have involved themselves in the ongoing conflict and are seeking to bring in other countries as well. They are now being targeted by the Yemeni army. The Yemeni armed forces are seeking to expand their operations and will not stop until the genocide committed by Israel in Gaza comes to an end.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, declared that the Yemeni army's naval operations would go on until the entry of food and medicine into Gaza is permitted. He emphasized that any escalation by the US and UK would yield contrary outcomes and would not diminish Yemen's resolve.
People in Yemen say they fully support all decisions made by the political and military leadership in confronting the Western powers. They have said that they have authorized the Yemeni army to escalate its naval operations until Israel ceases its genocidal war in Gaza. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Donald Trump has notched his second straight win in the Republican presidential nominating race by defeating his last remaining major rival, Nikki Haley, in the New Hampshire primary. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump won the New Hampshire Republican primary. CBS News has projected defeating his sole remaining rival, Nikki Haley, in a victory That further cements his status as the clear frontrunner to become the GOP's 2024 presidential nominee. While Trump's final margin of victory remained to be seen as of late Tuesday night, 23rd of January, his win in the Granite State deals a blow to Nikki Haley's efforts to unite an anti-Trump coalition of moderate Republicans and independents, capable of slowing his march to the nomination. Speaking after Donald Trump's victory came into focus, Nikki Haley said she would remain in the race, telling her supporters that this race is far from over. "I have news for all of you. New Hampshire is the first in the nation. It's not the last in the nation," she said. The former United Nations ambassador and former governor of South Carolina faced immediate pressure from Trump supporters to drop out of the race and unite the Republican Party, a preview of the likely next phase of the campaign. Trump declared victory soon after she spoke and criticized the upbeat tone of her speech, saying she had a very bad night. Haley had been closing the gap with Trump in the weeks leading up to the New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary, and the electorate in Tuesday's contest was far more moderate than the voters who delivered Trump's victory in the Iowa caucuses. Republicans eager for an alternative to Trump had hoped that the state's large number of independent voters who could participate in either party's contest would propel Nikki Haley to victory. But the time and money she and her backers devoted ultimately weren't enough to loosen Donald Trump's grip on the Republican Party. With his win in New Hampshire and decisive victory in Iowa, Trump has now topped the first two contests of the 2024 election cycle. The winners of the primary in the Granite State in the last four competitive election cycles have gone on to secure the party's presidential nomination, including Donald Trump in 2016. No Republican in the modern primary era has lost the nomination after winning both Iowa and New Hampshire. 22 Republican delegates out of the 2,391 up for grabs nationwide are at stake in New Hampshire, which allocates delegates proportional to a candidate's share of the vote in the state. Donald Trump is projected to win at least 12 delegates, and Nikki Haley is projected to win at least 9. Trump celebrated his win late on Tuesday, 23rd of January, in a victory speech in Nashua, while railing against Nikki Haley for celebrating her second-place finish. Flanked by the likes of former White House hopefuls Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Vivek Ramaswamy, along with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Donald Trump criticized Nikki Haley without naming her, saying she had a very bad night. "She's doing a speech like she won. She didn't win, she lost, Trump said. Trump briefly ceded the microphone to Vivek Ramaswamy, who said Nikki Haley's continued presence in the race is representative of the ugly underbelly of American politics. President Biden's re-election campaign, meanwhile, wasted no time in pivoting towards the general election, saying in a statement that Donald Trump had locked up the GOP nomination with his victory in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire results, the campaign said, showed that the election-denying anti-freedom MAGA movement has completed its takeover of the Republican Party. The campaign contrasted Joe Biden's agenda with Donald Trump, saying that the former president would undermine American democracy and ban abortion nationwide. "Joe Biden sees things differently," the campaign said. "He's fighting to grow our economy for the middle class, strengthen our democracy, and protect the rights of every single American." With the projected results out of New Hampshire, the Biden campaign said it's increasingly clear that Trump will be on the ballot in November, where it says he'll face the only person to have ever beaten him at the ballot box, Joe Biden. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson congratulated Donald Trump for his projected win in New Hampshire on Tuesday night, calling it a decisive victory, while making clear that the House Republican leadership supports his re-election campaign. Mike Johnson wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, "Republican voters in Iowa and New Hampshire have strongly backed Donald Trump at the polls, It's now past time for the Republican Party to unite around President Trump. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story. Donald Trump is projected to have notched his second straight win in the Republican presidential nominating race by defeating his last remaining major rival, Nikki Haley, in New Hampshire's primary on Tuesday night, 23rd of January. But while the former president was on track for a double-digit win over Nikki Haley as of late Tuesday, with votes still being counted, he quickly lashed out at his former United Nations ambassador, who said in her own remarks that "our fight is not over," as she looked ahead to the next major primary in my sweet state of South Carolina. Donald Trump, speaking shortly after Nikki Haley at his own event, mocked her attitude. "Who the hell was the imposter that went up on the stage before and claimed the victory?" he said in a drastically different tone after his commanding victory in the Iowa caucuses last week when he praised his opponents. Trump suggested he was angered at the way Haley had handled the results, then added, "I don't get too angry, I get even." The dueling remarks suggest where the primary race is headed next, with Nikki Haley calling herself scrappy and a fighter, insisting that her ability to lose by less to Trump in New Hampshire shows she can eventually manage to crack open his base of support by continuing to challenge him first in South Carolina and then on Super Tuesday in March, and even beyond. "This race is far from over," she said on Tuesday night. "There are dozens of states left to go." Trump, who remains in a commanding lead in the polls and an increasing number of major Republican endorsements, didn't see it that way. "She failed badly," he said. Indeed, New Hampshire had been seen by political experts as Nikki Haley's best battleground against Donald Trump, and she entered primary day with several advantages, including a key endorsement from the state's popular governor, Chris Sununu, and an open primary format that allowed more favorable, independent-leaning voters to cast ballots for her, and an electorate that is more college-educated. The race had also finally narrowed down to just two major candidates, Nikki Haley and Donald Trump, after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' departure from the race on Sunday. Some opinion polls leading up to the primary showed Nikki Haley within single digits of Donald Trump, but his lead widened as the day got closer and closer, and Haley's allies stopped predicting a landslide and instead began to argue that a strong second-place showing would give her momentum. As Haley's profile has risen as the main Trump alternative, Trump and his allies have targeted her more and more, including mispronouncing her name and falsely claiming she's not eligible to be president of the United States because her parents are immigrants. She has gotten more critical of him too, including suggesting that Trump is mentally unfit to be in the White House.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my two guest speakers, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Yasser, salam alaikum, welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaikum, and welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, you know, in these episodes of Viewpoint, the movie critique program, we attempt to criticize movies normally with a religious theme. And one of the movies that we decide actually to work on from this episode onwards, inshallah, is Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov. Well, let's take a short listen to a trailer of this movie, and then we'll be back with somehow demographic information about this movie, and then the questions and answers from you guys. Stay with us and don't go away.
I'm going to leave this place soon.
I knew this day would come. Be wise, be careful. Everything you ever need is inside you, my son.
I have been searching for you, Mr. Ward. You are the seventh son of a seventh son.
An order of noble knights combating the forces of darkness.
It says here that there are 1,000 of you.
They've all died. We are all that's left.
Teach me.
Live in a world now where legend and nightmare are real.
Signs of evil are everywhere.
Your queen has returned. The world of man shall fall.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with Mama Jawad hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser helping me criticize the movie The Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov. This is a movie which is produced in 2014 with Jeff Bridges, Julianne Moore, Alicia Vikander, and Ben Barnes, to just name a few. Well, IMDb actually gave this movie 5.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 12%, which is a low figure in comparison. And the box office for this movie was a little over $100 million dollars. That's about $114.2 million. And the budget that I found was about $100 million. Well, the whole movie revolves around witchcraft. The aging master wizard John, or Master Gregory, needs an apprentice when a malicious witch escapes from his coffin. After searching high and low, he finds Thomas, hoping that he can learn the art and help the locals instead of him. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, how do you like this movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The movie was okay. I mean, nothing extravagant, nothing to wow about. It's decent, it's watchable. It's got a reasonable, entertaining graphics and what have you.
Yes.
Great, you know, nature scenes and stuff, yes, like that. Nothing fancy in terms of storyline. Storyline is very basic. What else is there? So it's overall, it's okay. It's a watchable, decent movie. I wouldn't say it's a movie that you must watch, mm-hmm, a movie that is amazing or the storyline is amazing. It's just an okay movie. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much the other ratings are, but like, I would give it like a 3 or 4 out of 10.
I see.
Yeah, if I want to be generous, maybe I'll push it to four for the graphics
and
the acting was, at least the acting was something that you can digest, you can watch.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you watch movies and then even the acting itself like really sucks. Uh-huh. So at least the movie is okay, the acting was okay, the characters were okay. They had a few famous people in the
movie.
How about
the plot? Did you like the plot?
The plot is just very repetitive.
Uh-huh.
It's not the first one, and I'm assuming it won't be the last one either. We've seen many of these witchcrafts. Kill the witch turns into a dragon, it turns into something else. And so it's a very repetitive storyline in Hollywood.
I see. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. We're going to continue criticizing this movie, Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. But after a short break, don't go away.
Master Gregory, do you not hear the bells?
There is a ringing in my ear.
In the village, in the old church, there's a child, no more than 10 years of age. She is infected.
You may note I'm presently not dealing with the otherworldly.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser helping me criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Well, Brother Yasser, nearly at the beginning of the movie, a man comes to a knight, Master Gregory, and asks him to help an innocent child who's infected. This is the word they use. Mm. What was the role of a knight? Of course, in this movie, they used to call him a spook. So what's the role of a knight or a spook in the olden days to help exorcism?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Not so much exorcism as per the 100 other movies we've watched and criticized, where a demon comes and, you know, takes over a person or does certain things or causes hallucinations, whatever. More the spook and a knight actually are two different things, but here they kind of combine them into two. A knight in the traditional British literature or in British, history, was a particular person who was ordained by the king or queen at that particular time.
Because of the bravery, for example.
For whatever certain skill set or whatever, to defend the country from foreign invaders.
Mm-hmm.
They were if you want to call them, the elite of the guard.
Mm-hmm.
They would be the elite, like the secret service, if you want to call them today.
Yeah.
So they were like the elite amongst the soldiers and amongst the... And they had special duties, special privileges, and so on and so forth. Whereas a spook was a person who dealt with evil things, evil spirits, black magic, sorcery, more like that. But here they kind of combined the two, like a group of knights who were ordained to protect the kingdom, who are also spooks at the same time. But in terms of protecting the kingdom from sorcery, from black magic, from evil.
Non-material
things
enemies.
Like this.
Yeah.
So you see throughout the movie, he knows these things, these certain things that were created. Obviously, it's a fantasy type of movie with fantasy type of creatures.
Yes.
So this person obviously had knowledge of these things, knowledge of old books, knowledge of traditional medicine, knowledge of traditional magic, traditional creatures,
yes.
Creatures of the night, creatures of the underworld. What is their weaknesses? As you see, he's teaching his apprentice that this is what is good for this is what is good for that. Obviously, the experience that he's seen.
Yes.
What is also fascinating in the movie, it is possible that he lived a very long life.
Mm.
It's very plausible that it is there, that you can see because of the beginning of the movie and then where he ends up and the lifespan of that particular witch as well. You can say that this particular person...
And he's the last of his kind.
The last of that particular group.
Yes.
So this is what a knight is traditionally in British literature. And the knights themselves were like a band of brothers. And together they fought, they died together and so on. So this is probably the same. As you see in the movie, he's very distraught. I don't know if you mentioned later when he finds out that his entire clan, he's the last one standing. He knows this. He feels distraught because those are obviously his brothers. Those are his brothers in arms, as they would call them.
Yes. But it was kind of creative for the director or the playwright, actually, to assign a new role to the knight.
Yeah, to combine these two kind of roles that were there, or these two kind of figures
I see
in traditional English fantasy literature.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014, and then we'll be back with his criticism. Don't go away.
Hatchet, silver bane, longbow. We'll need the silver net.
Please save her.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Said Abdullah helping me as my guest speakers to criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Said Abdullah, nearly again at the beginning of the movie, they are preparing to help the child, Master Gregory and some of the guys. I mean, especially with his apprentice, with some kind of silver tools. This is nearly the beginning of the movie that tries to introduce some objects and gives us some information about that. You know, what's so special about silver? As you might have seen in lots of other movies, like for example with Blade, as you can see. Wesley Snipes in that movie try to attack the hearts of vampires with silver pails or whatever tools so that they could be destroyed.
Yeah.
Other than that, it didn't work on them, right?
Yes.
So is that really helpful? I mean, such metals like silver?
I mean, like you said, so in this particular movie itself, I don't know why they had to refer to silver, because silver usually is preserved for vampires. It's not preserved for witches.
Yeah.
The witches usually give them the cross or possession of the holy water. I don't know, sometimes they might use silver crosses. But usually the silver and the glitter that they use in the movie, usually these are in reference to vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Me personally, I haven't come across any study or any, what do you call it, or any culture that says that silver is something that you can use to defeat demon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Islamically, we have a very much istihbab, a very much recommendation for men to wear silver. Like with their silver ring or something with silver. And this is something that's been done until today. So the Imam alayhi salam used to do it, the Prophet used to do it. They would have something silver in their hand. Now, how effective is silver in defending a person from spiritual and supernatural things is, I'm not sure. But obviously there's a relationship, there's a link between silver and fending off supernatural or entities.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there wouldn't be a recommendation on wearing it. So,
some of these cultures, these practices, these rituals, withstood time. Well, it's been given to us by the legacy of mankind. Like, for example, the gemstones. Or, for example, when you're when you marry, for example. But we may not know the true nature or reality of what's behind it, basically.
Yeah, right? So across cultures, it doesn't matter which culture you pick, it doesn't matter what civilization you pick, they all had their own omens, and they all had their, what are they called, tantums or tattoos, whatever they call them. So each culture would have their own. Sometimes it stemmed from something proper,
mm-hmm.
but along the line, the actual story was distorted, but the practice remained.
Mm-hmm.
We had the same thing in Islam, where, for example, we've been told to wear things, like you said, jewels or gems.
Like, for example,
gems.
Gold is not good, actually, for the men.
Yeah, I mean, now we understood that medically, but that's just recently. Uh-huh. But before that, it was just haram, forbidden to wear. Why would it know? It was just for women. Now we understood the causes.
But so, silver is recommended.
But silver is more, is like extremely recommended, yes, to wear. So like I said, so sometimes even with these cultures, even like, for example, in Christianity, I don't know what, because Christianity is known for stealing things from other cultures or from other religions and incorporating it in there. So maybe they took it from another culture that was close to Christianity, where they dealt with silver as a way to fend spirits and you know, supernatural things, and then they make it their own, and then they put it in the culture of the movie when it comes to vampires, when it comes to exorcism, when it comes to stuff like that.
Dark ages.
But the original of it, not that I'm aware of.
Mm. Thank you very much, Syed Abdullah, and thank you very much, Brother Yasser, for your comments and feedback and criticism of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. With me, Mohammad Javad, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
If you see a witch, kill it.
We're not all evil, you know.
I can't do this. I'm not like you.
Join us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. German industrial output unexpectedly declined in November, underscoring the persistent manufacturing woes in Europe's largest economy. The Statistics Office of Germany said on Tuesday, 9th of January, production declined 0.7% from October, led by capital goods and intermediate goods. That's the sixth consecutive drop and defies economists in a Bloomberg survey who had predicted a 0.3% increase. Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. Manufacturers, Germany's economic backbone, are struggling from costly energy, higher global interest rates, and a slowdown in the Chinese economy. Bloomberg economists said disappointing November production data and the recent business expectations deterioration point to a bumpy start to the year for industry in Germany. We maintain our baseline view for a slight gross domestic product increase in the first quarter of 2024, driven by a higher dynamic in the service sector. There is substantial risk, however, that a more pronounced industry weakness will drag the economy down again in the first quarter of 2024. The figures come just a day after a reading for factory orders also fell short of expectations. Additionally, with the German government straitjacketed over ramping up investment and train strikes looming recently, few economists anticipate much of a pickup this year. German railway operator Deutsche Bahn AG's attempt to halt strikes by a court injunction was rejected by Frankfurt's labor court on Monday, 8th of January. Speaking to Bloomberg Television after Tuesday data was released, Holger Schmieding, chief economist at Berenberg, claimed Germany is experiencing cyclical rather than structural issues and will bounce back as the manufacturing sector returns to significant growth in the second half of 2024. He said Germany was in recession last year, yes, but the indicators are starting to stabilize. We are bottoming out in the German economy. Meanwhile, citing the country's federal network agency, the German magazine Der Spiegel writes, households in Germany will continue to struggle with high electricity and heating costs amid the cost of living crisis. The warning comes despite the recent fall in household energy prices, which have decreased 4.5% this year compared to November of last year. The head of the federal network agency, Klaus Müller, was quoted as saying in an interview with the Rheinische Post, "The era of cheap energy is over, at least as long as we continue to consume large quantities of conventionally generated energy." Klaus Müller added, "Although wholesale electricity prices have fallen significantly compared to 2022, the price level is still higher than before the start of the Ukraine conflict," adding that nothing will change in the near future. The energy regulator noted that an average four-person household will pay €120 more in network fees per year due to the government's decision to eliminate the previously planned €5.5 billion subsidy. Müller assumed network operators will pass the price rise on to German customers, predicting sooner or later the cost will reach all consumers regardless of when the changes are implemented. Germany's transmission system operators reportedly announced in mid-December that the grid fees will rise from 3.12 cents per kilowatt hour in 2023 to 6.43 cents next year. Germany, which relied on Russia for 40% of its natural gas demand before 2022, was among the hardest hit by the reduction of Russian energy supplies to Europe last year. Deliveries were either significantly curtailed or entirely halted after the European Union imposed sanctions on Moscow in response to the Ukraine conflict, and the Nord Stream pipelines delivered Russian gas to Germany mysteriously blew up. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. German farmers started a week of nationwide protests early on Monday, 8th of January, in response to plans to phase out agricultural subsidies as the coalition government scrambles to fix its finances. Images showed convoys of tractors and trucks, some adorned with protest banners on German roads in sub-zero pre-dawn temperatures. German police reports said that roads and highway ramps were blocked in multiple locations, causing traffic jams during the morning rush hour. Farmers have vowed to blockade major traffic and logistics routes throughout next week. On Monday, 15th of January, as they warned that an end to tax breaks will drive farms out of business. The head of German Farmers Association, DBV, asked the public for sympathy in an interview published on Monday, 8th of January. He told the Stern magazine, "We do not want to lose the support and solidarity we have received from large parts of the German population." But he said the farmers will not accept the planned tax hikes for the agricultural sector. Recent backlash from farmers prompted the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition, racing to finalize a 2024 budget draft that was delayed by a court ruling, to make unexpected changes, including modifying plans to cut subsidies for agriculture. Rather than abruptly ending the farmers' tax breaks on agricultural diesel, the subsidy will be reduced by 40% this year, by 30% next year, and will end entirely in 2026. The government also dropped plans to abolish the preferential treatment in vehicle tax for forestry and agriculture. However, the DBV said the changes were not enough and stuck with plans for protests in the coming days. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has also covered the same story. According to an opinion poll by YouGov, at least 74% of the German public disapprove of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's performance, making it the highest level of dissatisfaction on record for a sitting German chancellor. At least 77% of the German public also said they place little to no trust in the way Olaf Scholz governs the country. And according to a separate opinion poll by Infotest DIMAP, if elections were held today, Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party, the SPD, would receive just 14% of the vote, which is 2% less than last month's figure and the lowest since June of 2021. A whopping 73% of the public also said they were unhappy with the traffic light coalition government, making it the worst monthly figure since the coalition first came to power. The opinion poll comes when Germany's economy has been particularly struggling ever since the government failed to repurpose 60 billion euros left over from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.